Does anybody like The Wire? Anybody watch The Wire? I really, really love The Wire. And so because I'm up here, I get to talk about The Wire today. Yeah, good. That's great. I recently started rewatching The Wire, HBO's big series that came out, like, I think 2001 was the first year, because a big behind-the-scenes history was just released, and I caught wind of this behind-the-scenes history, and I was like, oh, man, I want to be back in that world. So I started rewatching The Wire. We're going to watch before, as we get going here. Kyle mentioned we hold off on our opening video. I'm going to do it right now for us to start us today. We're going to watch one of the most moving scenes to me from The Wire. It's from the first season, so, and it's also been out for a while. So I probably should say, like, spoiler, but it's not really. It doesn't really spoil anything, but I might give something away. But it's been out for a while, so it's your fault if you don't know. This is what we're going to watch is two characters going to a 12-step Narcotics Anonymous meeting. One of them is Bubbles is his name. He's one of the kind of protagonists of the series. We follow him a lot throughout the five seasons of the show. And then it's his friend with him, Johnny. You'll see him going to the meeting with a guy. And both of these guys are addicted to heroin, okay? And they're going to this Narcotics Anonymous meeting. Just a quick heads up, in case it's an issue for me, there's just a few spats of language here, nothing too crazy, but just keep that in mind. If that makes you feel uncomfortable, I'm sorry for that. But let's watch.
We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God.
Are you going to sign it?
No. Need that back when the meeting's over. And if you don't stay, we don't sign it.
That works. I want to see
the show. I haven't seen some of these faces in so long.
Same thing, Anna.
Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other addicts and practice these principles in all our affairs.
Today's speaker is going to be Waylon, who, if you come to these meetings, you have to know.
Well, here y'all all know I'm Waylon and I'm an addict. And the fact is that I want to be clean today more than I want to be high.
I know that's all right.
It's good to be here. It's good to be anywhere clean. Even Balmer. I've been clean a few 24 hours now, and I'm still dead certain that my disease wants me dead. Yeah, I'm in here with y'all talking shit about how strong I am, how strong I feel. But my disease is out there in that parking lot doing push-ups on steroids, waiting for the chance to kick my ass up and down the street again. Scars on my hands, on my feet, two bouts of endocarditis, hep C and whatnot, knocking down walls and kicking out windows in my liver. I lost a good wife, bad girlfriend, and the respect to anyone that ever tried to loan me money or do me a favor. Pawned my pickup, my bike, my National Steel guitar, and a stamp collection that my granddad left me. And when it was almost over for me, and I was out there on them corners, not a pot to piss in, and anyone that ever knew me or loved me cussing my name, you know what I told myself? I said, Waylon, you're doing good. I surely did. I thought I was God's own drug addict. And if God hadn't meant for me to get high, he wouldn't have made being high so much like perfect. Now, I know I got one more high left in me, but I doubt very seriously if I have one more recovery. So if there's anybody out there that sees that bottom coming up at them, I'm here to talk sense. I don't care who you are, what you done, or who you done it to. If you're here, so am I.
That's right.
The Mustard Seed Group gives out keychains for stretches of clean time. So if you've earned it, come on up and get it. Does anybody have 9 months? Does anybody have 6 months? Does anybody have 3 months? Does anybody have 1 month? And now for the most important person in this room. Does anybody have 24 hours or a sincere desire to live?
Yeah, all right. Where you stand, buddy?
Yeah, we shoved off this morning.
Accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change things I can. And wisdom to...
I said, Waylon.
I just really like that scene. What I want to say today is that churches at their best are that 12-step meeting. There's nothing special to draw your attention to this meeting. There's no incredible music. There's no coolness. Seems to be in some random church gym, fold-up chairs, a couple of volunteers to help. One of the characters that we're following, Johnny, doesn't even want to be there, obviously. But when everyone starts clapping as they hand out, like, sobriety keychains, do you get goosebumps like I do? Like, do you feel a little bit of, like, do you feel a little emotional? And then Bubbles, who if you watch the show, you really love. So I'm like extra invested in this because I watch the show. And he gets up and you just like that just, there's a moment there where something is grabbing him, some message of promise and hope. And I just lose, like this is fictional. These are made up characters, but I'm still kind of losing it. And when I recently started rewatching this, I mentioned, and I got to the scene and I guess I'd had like a pretty, emotional day before this, but I was like crying uncontrollably for a little bit when the first woman gets up at like when they say, does anyone have 3 months? And then the applause start. Like I was just like sitting there watching on my iPad, like crying in my room for a little bit. Yeah. Bubbles' story in The Wire is one of the most redemptive in the whole series. Actually later in this episode, Bubbles and Johnny are using again. And so it's not necessarily that this resolve sticks right away, but there was something there that grabbed him. And this is kind of, if we watch the whole series, this is like the first thing that we witness of like him on a path toward redemption. And so this message in this 12-step meeting is, to me, it's like so beautiful and it's pure. That the question that the volunteer asks is, does anyone have 24 hours or a sincere desire to live? That question, that is real as life gets. It is not a cheap religious message. It's not an empty promise that when dug into a bit is probably going to fall apart or can't be delivered on. It's not in the least bit predatory or salesman-y. It's not taking advantage of someone or like trying to, some like special public servant or minister trying to get an inspiring story that they can tell about what they do. The question is just pure. It's as pure as spirituality gets. Does anyone have a sincere desire to live? And that wave that I feel, and I don't know if any of you were feeling, even in a fictional story, when the clapping for everyone starts, and especially for who they call the most important people in the room, does anyone have 24 hours? Anyone or a sincere desire to live? That, I think, when we get that in real life, it is God knitting people together in solidarity to do the hardest things that life presents us with. And when church gives people experiences like this, that is what I think is true spirituality. Because I think the thing is that it is not just substance abuse that can be helped by the 12 steps. A Franciscan priest, Richard Rohr, who is a sort of historian of spirituality, he argues that the 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, things like that, first developed by Bill Wilson in the early 20th century, Father Rohr says it is the greatest American contribution to the history of spirituality. It's like, what is more American than a step-by-step instruction manual, right? Like, that's... And despite the many ways that we can point to, like, Americans or American culture maybe stunting the history of spirituality, I'm sure we can point to many of those things, this is something that, like, Americans actually excel at and have offered to the wider story of, like, what does it mean to follow Jesus and connect with God? Making overcoming addiction feel doable with a step-by-step instruction manual. And so this is true for the hardest sort of addiction you can imagine, like substance abuse. Yes, but Rohr says, Father Rohr says, what if we treated anything in our life that is not serving us as addiction? That's quite an interesting question. Like, to use the religious word, what if we treated any sin in our life, big or small, as addiction, and then tried to live the 12 steps as a lifestyle? So I have the 12 steps up here on the screen for us. I want to read it for us. It's also in your program if you're following along that way. And I want you to think not just, like, while I read this, I want you to get kind of internal. Listen to me, but also kind of think in your own head. I don't want you to think just about alcoholism or substance abuse or sex addiction or whatever. But I want you to call to mind anything in your life that feels like a high in the moment, but then you realize later it's not serving you. So the high that you feel when, like, of feeling right or justified by passive-aggressively letting someone have it. You ever feel that high? Do you feel the high of, like, the high of evading trouble by telling some small lie? The high of getting our way by manipulating people or situations? The high of feeling an escape from our challenges by disappearing from our lives? Take a minute here. I'll even give us, like, a moment just to be quiet, just to reflect, and then I'm going to read the 12 steps, okay? So take a moment. Okay. So step one. We admitted we were powerless over our addiction, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we were entirely ready to have God remove all those defects of character. Step seven, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, we made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Step 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other addicts and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So I wonder how all of that hits you. I mean, so we all could be later asked by someone, how was church? And we'll say, well, they told me I was an addict. That may not sound great. But I want to say, I actually don't think this is a downer of a message at all. In a sense, I actually think this is empowering. So on paper, my brother, who passed away almost 3 years ago now, was a screw-up and an alcoholic. and I was a good kid who ended up becoming a pastor. But it's my brother who had something to teach me, and not really the other way around, I think. So he came to a point when he realized what was actually feeding him in life through the 12 steps of AA. AA taught him how to pursue that really humbly and courageously. I remember particularly his pursuit of steps 8 and 9, the make a list of all persons who we have harmed and become willing to make amends, and then make direct amends whenever possible. So he reached out to me when he was in town 1 week to sit down over coffee, and that was something that we had literally never done in our lives. But we get together at this coffee shop, and he expresses specifically to me what he had felt that he'd done to hurt me. And he like directly, with a very clean question, asked for my forgiveness. He looked me in the eye and said, "I love you, Vince." And I think that I was like really uncomfortable and kind of like shifty in the situation because I'd never experienced this with my brother. I mean, I don't know how much intimacy I've experienced with anybody along those lines. But I look back now at that time in this coffee shop with my brother, and I think it's one of the most spiritual things that's ever happened to me in my entire life. I got to taste a little bit of what my brother discovered through the 12-step program. And the way that that impacted me is it encouraged me to do some searching and fearless moral inventory of what are things in my life that aren't serving me. You know, my need to be right and to get my way, which leads me to manipulating people. My need to feel like I am living up to my ideals, which leads to me shaming myself. What if those are addictions? What if I am addicted to feeling right? What if I am addicted to getting that high of feeling like my ideals and what I'm actually doing in life match? I just want that harmony so bad, and I will go to such lengths. I will even hurt myself or hurt other people, do other things that aren't in line with my ideals just to get a feeling like in some way I am. You know, the way that trying to do this, trying to treat these things in my life as addiction has changed me, it is not at all that it has made me more of a downer. Like, it's made me more joyful. It's made me more relaxed. It's made me more fun to be around. My wife would tell you that. Like, there is a power in an embrace of powerlessness. And it is an unexpected power. We would not think that embracing powerlessness would be empowering. It's not a power that the world like recognizes or wants to put on display, but it's one that our hearts just like recognize intuitively, I think. I think it's why I get emotional when I see that scene in The Wire. Like, there's something about that feels, oh yes, I'm recognizing, my heart is recognizing something deep and true there. To me, the 12 steps are, this is like one of the greatest expressions there is of following Jesus, of the gospel of Jesus. We're in the middle right now of the 40 days of Lent, the season in the church calendar where we prepare to mark Jesus' death on the cross on Good Friday and his resurrection on Easter Sunday. Jesus on the cross stands in solidarity with human powerlessness. He tells us to look to him on the cross for life. That means look to your powerlessness for life. And then Jesus' resurrection, this idea that God had so much power in this embrace of powerlessness that it raised Jesus from the dead. That is God's guarantee that he will back up his promise to give us life. This is not an empty promise. This works. Should we make ourselves entirely ready for God to remove our defects of character and our shortcomings and humbly ask him to do so, as the steps say, he will meet us. He will give us the power to carry out his good will in our lives. The 12 steps is like, it's just like a really concrete way for us to, like, if we could just see ourselves, there's verbs in them. Like, I have an action step. Great. We love action steps in America, right? Every meeting ends with, like, what are your action items? Like, we love this. This is a tangible, like, you can get your hands around way to live out the death and resurrection of Jesus in your own life. So St. Paul wrote about this in one of his letters to the Corinthian church. I want to read basically a whole chapter from that letter here, so it's going to feel a little bit long. But the reason I'm doing that is I want you to kind of feel just how 12-step sounding this is, okay? We're going to read like a whole chapter from Paul here. It's in your program, and I'll read here. So for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I, God, will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent, I, God, will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. You might think about how I read this. God chose my brother, the alcoholic, not me, the good kid who became a pastor. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. And so it was with me, brothers and sisters, Paul says. When I came to you, I did not come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, with great fear and trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on human wisdom, but on God's power. We do, however, speak a message of wisdom among the mature, but not the wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing. No, we declare God's wisdom, a mystery that has been hidden, that God destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. However, as it is written, what no eye has seen, what no ear has heard, what no human mind has conceived, are the things God has prepared for those who love him. These are the things God has revealed to us by his Spirit. I think Paul's relationship with Jesus, which we just get a little bit of a picture of in these words, put him in touch with his powerlessness. And that wasn't a terrible thing to him. That was an amazing and freeing and life-giving thing. He talks about the quality of the life being something no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived of. That's how good his life was. He realized, he came to a point, if we follow the story of Paul, who was such a religious zealot that he was murdering people that disagreed with him. We follow his life where he gets to the point where he realizes, my life has become unmanageable, and I need a power outside of myself to restore me to sanity. So he makes friends with his powerlessness. That's his story. And in the words of the 12 steps, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of this, he tried to carry that message to others and to practice these principles in all his affairs. This is sadly not what churches are popular for offering, what I'm talking about. I think churches, generally most of us think, is like, here's a course on morality, and here's a message to scare or shock you into operating with as much willpower as possible so you don't, like, touch that morality electric fence. But fear of a morality electric fence is really only good at keeping people who already, like, feel in exactly where they are for the rest of their life, and keeping people who are out staying out. That's what a morality electric fence is good for. Movement, change, growth in human behavior, being a different person than you were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 1 year ago, that's all secondary in that. In the way of the 12-step program, the way of Paul's words that we just read, the way of the death and resurrection of Jesus, these are about actual change, movement, growth, life transformation, being a different person today than you were yesterday, not a morality electric fence. And so I think churches at their best are like a 12-step program. They're like that meeting we watched from The Wire. As a pastor, when people talk to me about wanting to grow or wanting to, like, know God more, this is how I know how close people are to getting what their desire is there. Does this person seem ready to treat every sin in their life, big or small, like it's addiction? I mean, that's not about appearing religious or appearing impressive. It's actually the opposite. It's like the people who I see are ready for this. They're not trying to impress anyone. It's just about what actually works to connect us with God, what actually works to grow as a human being, to see your life moving in a good direction. And it is scary at first. You have to stand up and you have to say, "I'm Vince and I'm an addict to something," right? And then you have to keep going to whatever your equivalent of a 12-step meeting is, right? Like, no one's special. No one can do this alone. There's a scene later in season one where Waylon, the guy who got up and was the speaker for that meeting, is talking to Bubbles, and Bubbles is like, he's waffled back and forth on this resolve, and Waylon just kind of looks at him, and it's a really loving conversation. He goes, "Do you want me to tell you you're special? Like, you got to go to meetings. Like, you're not special. You're just like everyone else." And so that's hard. But then when we begin to do this, like, we experience that incredible quality of life that I think Paul described. So if we, like, what we've been doing, what we've been dreaming about during Lent here every week in our talks, if our community experienced this, experienced the 12 steps changing our lives every single day, imagine how that would change us. Imagine how that would change the people who call this place home. But beyond that, imagine how that would impact our neighborhoods, our city, the world that we occupy every week. Imagine how spiritual just coffee with a family member or a friend could feel, like I experienced. Imagine what strong's relationships we would build, how much more support we would feel, and how much more support we would feel able to offer others. Imagine how differently we would engage our work if we are consistently asking God humbly to remove our character defects. Imagine what better work-life balance we would discover and therefore have more energy for the people in our lives and for our own lives. Imagine how differently we would orient ourselves to the poorest among us in our neighborhoods, not out of pity, but out of solidarity. Imagine the reputation that our church could have in Lincoln Square, in the Brownline area, in Chicago. Like, those people, the Brownline Vineyard, like, they know how damn hard life is. They get it. And they give me the spiritual equivalent of, like, a sobriety keychain. They applaud for me. They point me not toward a morality electric fence. They point me toward a God who, like, is eager to help. A God who's, wow, like, this God is amazing. So I want to put the 12 steps back up here. And to close today, as we do every week, I want to pray for us. And I want to encourage us again to take a moment and just reflect. And then I want to pray for us along these. I mean, the beauty of these, of the 12 steps, the American thing about an instruction manual, like, maybe we're all somewhere in some addiction on these 12 steps. So that gives us a lot of helpful language to pray. So can I ask you all, if you would, to stand with me? I'll invite our band up and they can get set here, and then I'm going to pray for us. Okay, you can close your eyes or open your eyes, whatever helps you to feel relaxed and present with us this morning. And I'm going to pray for us. Oh God, help us to search our hearts and do that kind of fearless and searching moral inventory thing. And I pray, God, for those of us who feel ready for that step one, we have a sincere desire to live today, to admit that we're powerless over our addictions and that our lives in this or that way is unmanageable. And we need a power higher than ourselves to restore us to sanity. For any of us ready to take that step, we ask for the grace, for your help, for the courage it requires to do that. I think about step five. For those of us who are ready to admit to you, to ourselves, and most specifically to another human being, the exact nature of our shortcomings, God, we ask for the courage to do that, if that's what's best for us right now. We ask that you would help us to feel entirely ready to ask you to meet us, to not be afraid of you and thinking that you're going to lay out a morality electric fence for us, but to ask you to meet us and to humbly ask you to remove our character defects and our shortcomings. We ask for an experience of you, God, today, who is like that. You are the God who is safe to do that with. So as we sing together, as we continue to pray together, we ask for you to continue to meet us in this way. We ask that you would, in that wonderful American concrete way, show us what this looks like this week, not just today. We ask for you to knit all of us together, those in this room, Brownline Vineyard community on Sunday, March 18th. Knit us together like that group that applauds for each other in the 12-step meeting in the Wire.